This podcast episode is powered by AfriPods, the world's number one podcasting platform for African stories.
Hello, welcome to another episode of the Kenyan Wall Street Podcast. This is Meet the Investor, hosted by Ali Mwakane Nogakweli. So today we're sitting with Nimrod Gaba from Vital Impact, and we want to talk about generally the investment space in Africa and address a few nitty-gritties on what Vital does, specifically focusing on Vital Impact Relief Fund, which recently gave two loan facilities to Solartech and Ivermats. I'm not so sure I say that right. And there it goes. Welcome, Nimrod.
Hi. Thanks very much, Ali. Thanks for having me.
No problem. So let's get to know you a little bit. What are the three things that Vital Capital would look for in a company before they invest in it?
Yeah, I think it's pretty simple. We'll look for, you know, good business and good business case. Mm-hmm. We'll look for good impact that the company is doing or plan to do. And the most important is we look for good people. So it would be good business, good impact, and good people. The better these three components are, the more chances we'll go in and partner with.
You know, when you say an impact, this is definitely something that we'll talk about as the show goes on. And what does good impact look like for you?
That's a very broad and interesting question. And actually, I think today we have much better answers for this specific question than we had 20 and or 10 or even 10 years ago. So 10 years ago, when we said that we're going to, you know, to pioneer impact investing in Africa, that was kind of a broad term that people could interpret it in different ways. I think today, the impact industry had progressed and advanced so much that you can actually say what you want to do and how you're going to monitor it and measure it during the life cycle of every investment. So it would be, you know, the do no harm, all the ESG aspects according to very well-defined criteria, and then it will be what is the positive impact that you're trying to achieve. And I think it will be very focus on what you can measure and what you can monitor, and not only, you know, goodwill declarations.
you have your goodwill declarations. So, you guys are private equity within this, or focus on the sub-Saharan Africa for around 10 years, right? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Maybe what makes you different from other investors, you know, in PE or in the impact space within Africa? What's your unique selling proposition as an investor?
I think, you know, we're very performance driven. We came from operational background, most of us, and, you know, we lived and worked in Africa. I personally lived in Africa more than a decade and worked much more. So we all came from, you know, managing businesses and managing projects. So we know the reality, and we look at things from this lens. So first of all, we look at things from the management and on the ground reality point of view. And later on, we look at that as investors. I think that allows us, first of all, to relate to local businesses much in a much closer way. We live the reality as the local business does, and less than a far away financial investor. And it allows us to look at opportunities that maybe traditional private equities will shy away from. So, you know, we're not afraid of greenfield and execution in the sectors that we know. We're not afraid of turnarounds. We're not afraid of, you know, majority stakes or very strong minority stakes. We want to be in a place that we drive the agenda. So I think sometimes the PEs are taking a more, I would say, distance or remote position, but we want to be in, we want to live the reality, and we have a lot to bring because we have been living this reality for so long.
I really want to get into you know, some of the sectors. I like that you mentioned that you guys are kind of different from, whether you have a unique approach compared to other private investment firms, and that I want to get into the sectors. But before, you know, before we get there, there's something that you mentioned that you guys came from a more operational approach, if you'd rather. What's the story behind, you know, the founding of Vital, and how did you guys, you know, decide to set up private equity and focus on sub-Saharan Africa?
That's a story I really like to reflect on, Ali, because it was kind of an interesting evolution. So we've been working in emerging markets with a lot of focus in sub-Saharan Africa for a while. So I've been 20 years working, my other partners are 25 years working. We've been actually, you know, managing projects as EPC partners or contractors, and then we've been managing small, medium businesses and larger businesses as CEOs and then managers and as project managers, as the guys on the ground that drive these things. And, you know, evolving and getting bigger, we found ourselves, you know, merging here and putting a bit of an equity there just because it was a need, not because it was a strategy, you know, and reality evolved. So we've been, you know, merging and taking more companies and investing a bit of equity here and investing a bit of equity there. And one day we woke up to find out that we were actually more investors than managers and operators. And then we said, okay, if we're investing so much, if we're bringing so much of our equity to the table, and we see that the reality in Africa changed and transformed from, you know, EPC stuff to equity and investment, skin in the game stuff, let's do it in a professional way. And then we decided to create Vital. So that all this evolution happened until 10 years ago. And in 2010, we woke up and said, okay, let's do investment as investment should be. And then we established Vital. We actually brought, you know, we had a very, very strong operational core, people like myself, you know, that are years in operation management. And then we brought, I would say, two different groups of people. One is, professional investors, people that came from, you know, that's their craft, institutional investing and more disciplined investment, a lot of ex-DFI guys. So that's one type of people that we brought. And the other are, impact investment people, people that, this is their profession. So they study that, they profess in impact. So, you know, we came with people like myself. We came with a very strong operational background, and then we brought people like the, you know, head of investment, you know, Francisco Machado, ex-DFIs that brought more disciplined investment practices, and then we brought people like Tamar Pashtan, head of impact, that brought the professional impact practice to the table, and that is the tripod where Vital sits on. So operational, investment, and impact.
You know, the beauty of having sort of evolved into investment, as you put it, you know, engaging in putting stakes in different companies before you actually started Vital, kind of lengthens the amount of time you had to, you know, understand the lay of the land and sort of collect impact, collect insights, if you'd rather, on Africa. What are some of the things that you've picked up throughout your investment journey, you know, pre-Vital and in Vital?
That's also a question that we try to stop and ask ourselves once in a while, in an organized way, because otherwise we might evolve to where it is easier. So I think you have to start from the ground up. You have to know the reality on the ground. If you wanna invest in logistic business, and you have to know, you know, what is the truck driver experience first. Okay, so I would, you know, if we're going to do a heavy on logistics, you know, on the road kind of trucking stuff, so we will go and we sit with the truck driver and we'll drive for 3 days on the exact roads where, you know, he's driving, so we will understand how it looks from his point of view. And I've done that, you know, and we're doing that all the time. So I would say the most important thing is to understand the realities on the ground and the motivation and incentives in the market from the ground level, not from the macro, you know, analysis of what's the trend for the next 20 years. I'm not saying there's no place for that. There's a lot of place for that, but it's not our place. other places from the ground, understanding the realities, understanding the motivation, understanding the limitation, and building the business around that. What we have learned and is that we want to be active. We don't want to, you know, sit and give, you know, advice, you know, remotely with, you know, from a board seat. We want to be active. We want to add value. We want to be involved. We want to be able to drive the agenda. And it fits, you know, some companies, it fits a lot and it works well. And others, you know, they would rather have a passive investor. So we understood that our value is where we are very active. So I would say we want to start from the ground, from the realities, from the market, and go up and build the case around that. And we want to be active, not, you know, come and visit or get the report and give some advice from the board. So that's not our specific place. Again, it is very related to our DNA. So that's a very strong thing that we learned, I would say, about ourselves. Another thing is that things change. Things are dynamic. I mean, we live in markets where there's some kind of crisis or very big change every few years. So it's not that you do a plan with some small contingencies and you hope that nothing will change. Things will change. It can be political, it can be pandemic, it can be economical crisis, it can be some macro stuff that immediately affect you know, where you invest in. And it's very different from the different places in Africa. So if you invest in Kenya or in Congo or in Ghana, it's very different. You know, maybe COVID affected everyone, all the economies, but you have, it's very dynamic. So you have to build your case, you have to build your business, both on the financial side and on the impact side, to be resilient to these changes. Our solution, our way, is again to go basic. So you know, if you supply water, or if you supply energy, or if you supply food, these are things that are more resilient to whatever change that you have. So you know, you can have you know, government can change, but food is still a need. And it will be very hard for the new government and very undesired for the new government to not to assist a business that creates, you know, food or water. You know what I'm saying? Unlike other businesses that are more related to the political agenda or the macro trends, etc. Yeah, there's so many other lessons that we learned, and we keep learning every day. I mean, COVID was a very interesting lesson for and challenge for everyone, and we're still learning. Definitely, we're still learning.
I really want to go into some of the challenges that you sort of encounter just based on, you know, operating within Africa, but that's definitely something that we'll get into, you know, as the podcast progresses. Maybe before we go on, what are some of the sectors that that, you know, Vital is looking into? And maybe just to add on to that, what are some of the milestones that you've achieved in these sectors, and what are some of the challenges that you've faced?
As I said, Ali, we go for the essential. So we go for food, we go for water, we go for healthcare, and we go for sustainable infrastructure. So mainly, you know, these are the main sectors that we aim for. And this is where we have a lot of knowledge and a lot of experience. And they are more resilient to change than others. So these are, I would say, the four sectors that we're busy with. Milestones. So, you know, after 10 years in private equity, you can already see and measure by results, not only by projections and intentions and Excels and PowerPoints, but actually the actual results. And we have very interesting milestones. I think we were one of the pioneering funds in Sub-Saharan Africa. You can look at the, you know, in the impact industry, you look at one of the first milestones in big impact investment in Africa. Is Vital Capital. So we've invested today $350 million in Sub-Saharan Africa in impact investment. We've done several exits. We have great financial performance. So, you know, we definitely perform much more than the average impact investor and the average PE in Africa, and maybe the average impact investor in emerging markets in growth markets as well. So we achieved very good financial results, and that's again money back to the investors. So it's not projections or anything like that. The cycle completed. Investors put money with the intention to make good returns and to make good impact, and they definitely ticked the make good returns box, and they definitely ticked the make amazing and transformative impact box. More than 6 million people have access to essential services like food, shelter, water, that they wouldn't have without the vital investment in the portfolio companies. Thousands of jobs, not temporary jobs, but permanent jobs, regional economical development. So I think we look back at these 10 years, and it was an amazing journey, difficult at times, challenging at times, actually difficult and challenges, almost every day. but when you look at both what you do and the transformation you're doing, and the same time, the financial returns you're able to give to your investors, I think that's definitely what we want to continue doing. And I think this is a showcase of how you can do impact investment in Africa without compromising, without trade-off, without asking people to donate money, without going to aid. On the other hand, with focus on the local communities and, low and middle income communities, and on how you create sustainable impact on the ground. So yeah, that was our journey so far.
Let's dive into impact investment a little bit. And I really, really have to ask this because we've had cases trending online where impact investment is viewed in the not so bright light, specifically with skepticism on, are we investing into this business because it is a sound business, or are we investing into this business simply because, there's a promise of a brighter future for a certain population. From a vital and personal point of view, if you will, how do you balance the importance of, impact and making sure this is actually a sound investment before you invest into it, and maybe during and after?
I understand your question. I think it's super important for impact investors to explain this well. And I think sometimes impact investment is perceived as something else than it really is. Now, let me first give a small disclaimer. There's a spectrum of impact investor, okay? So not everyone is the same. Some of them in this spectrum, some of them aim for different stuff. I want to represent ourselves here, and maybe not impact investment as an industry. Okay, I want to represent how we look at impact investment. So how do we balance the impact and the financial performance? We do not balance. We do not want to trade off. We do not want to enter a place where you have to trade off between impact and financial. So if I look at an opportunity, the financial teams will look at and ask themselves only the financial question, regardless of impact. Okay, is that a very good business that will make good returns as investors? As if there's no impact, and the impact team will ask themselves, is that a good business impact-wise that will make the outcomes that we're aiming for, regardless of the financials? So we call that, dual gatekeeper. It goes back from the initial teams that do the due diligence. They don't sit on the same in the same table and have brainstorming when the financial guys would say, it's a great business. You guys in the impact side, don't give us a hard time. It doesn't happen that way. It's totally separate. Discussion, impact discussed on the impact outcomes, financial discussed on the financial outcomes, and only if these two are satisfying, and only if these two are above what we're looking for, it goes actually up and enters the process. And, if we look at the deal and it's not profitable business, it will not pass to the next phase of analyzing. Okay, so we have that right at the beginning when it enters the pipeline. And we have another station right at the end in the investment committee. So we have an investment committee and we have an impact committee. Okay, the impact committee has a veto. Okay, so if the investment committee said, that's a great business, we love it, but the impact committee said that there's not enough impact, it will not fly. So all the way through from the beginning of the funnel to the end, these two things exist. And again, you should look at the business and you should look at the financials as if there's no impact, and you should look at the impact as if there's no financials. Only if these two are good enough and what you're looking for, then you can go on. Now, one can say, but wait, what happens if two very similar twin opportunities come and the impact is 7.5 and the financial is 6.8, and the other twin opportunity is exactly the mirror. Well, it doesn't happen. I mean, not in our reality. In our reality, we struggle to get good opportunities. So, it's a theoretical, philosophical, legitimate question, but it's not a realistic, practical question. Because, we're fighting for flow, we're fighting for pipeline, we're fighting for good opportunities. And a good opportunity that both passes what we're trying to achieve in the impact and what we're trying to achieve in the financials is rare to find, right? You have to struggle for that. You hardly have, two twin opportunities or, very similarly, you have to make these judgments and discussions.
I like the fact that you talked about impact and financials sort of being two separate boxes that a business has to, check both for you to proceed, and which feeds into my next question. And I might have to modify this a little bit based on your reality here. What are some of the due diligence processes that Vital Impact engages in just to make sure that this business is impact sound? Vis-a-vis, what are some of the things that you look at to make sure that this business is, it makes business sense before then you merge those two? Again, this is based on the presumption that you've sat on both tables before.
I would say again, and that's to echo what you mentioned at the beginning. You will not do positive, sustainable impact if the business is not financially sound. I mean, if the business will lose money, the impact will be negative. It will not be positive, it will be negative, because you will introduce a service to a place, and then when the company goes bust, this service will disappear. So, people might, you have a white elephant, or you have a service that people bought and paid for, and, they spent money and they actually cannot use that. And we see that so many times. We see that everywhere in Africa and in other, developing countries around the world, you see this. You see the result of not looking on financial soundness as sustainability. So we're not confused there. We're not thinking that, you have to reduce the profits if you want to increase the impact. Not at all. If you want something to be sustainable, it has to be a profitable business. If you want it to be scalable, it has to be very profitable business. The more profitable it is, the easier it will be to bring investors in and to scale it. I mean, that's common sense. So, but somehow when it comes to impact and to low and middle income communities, people tend to see it other ways, maybe, from the aid perspective, which is, the historical aid perspective, and maybe a philanthropical lens. If you want it to be sustainable, it has to be profitable. If you want it to be scalable, it has to be very profitable. The more profitable it be, the more scalable it will be, and the more impact that will do. So if I have more investors in, I will be able to create more impact. If I have a losing business, I will probably create negative impact in the end of the story. And I might, create white elephants or, white elephant services that people have. And that's where we don't want it. So when we do the due diligence, the financial, I would say there's no special treatment on the financial due diligence because we look at that as an impact investment. It will be financial due diligence and business due diligence as if we're not impact investors. Okay? So all the financial due diligence will be normal, traditional, conventional financial due diligence, regardless of what this business is. Okay. And the input due diligence would be, you know, first of all, see that it's within what we want to deal with. So, you know, we have exclusion lists, you know, we don't do, you know, oil and gas, we won't do commercial logging, etc. So first of all, to see that it's not in the exclusion list. Then to see all the ESG parameters, basically that, you know, you do no harm. You can do, you know, wonderful social business and damage the environment, and you can do wonderful financial business and, you know, damage local communities, and you can do wonderful social business for one social segment and damage another, or, you know, hurt other social segments or other communities. So first of all, do no harm. That's the first thing. First of all, do no harm. And the second thing would be, what is the positive impact that you're trying to create? What's the theory of change? What is your contribution? Would that business happen even if you were not there? And then you're just, you know, joining a trend and calling yourself an investment. We don't want to do that. We want to see our delta. We want to see our contribution to investment. And then who is positively affected, you know, by this investment? Who are the beneficiaries of this business? Is it related and to the community and the locality that it is within? Or is it just, you know, there's a cheap land somewhere, and then you build something that has nothing to do with the local, with the locality where it is, and it's totally disconnected, which again, we find that if we want something to be resilient, it has to be connected to where it is geographically and to the beneficiaries and to the communities. We will do all that, and we will create a very clear metrics of what we're trying to achieve, how we're going to measure it, and how we're going to monitor it. So the due diligence would be all that. So if the impact due diligence will say, okay, we can do that, that's the corrective plan, for example, for an existing business. That's the corrective plan for the ESG. I'll give an example. It's a great dairy factory. It creates, you know, food security. It's great. It's all good. Affordable products, you know, local production, local consumption, helping smallholder farmers, it's all good, but the waste from the dairy factory today goes, you know, right to the river. So when we come as investor, we'll say, well, that's the corrective plan that we want to be to do there. And of course, everything you want to do has financial implications. So it will not be that's the desire. It will be, this is it. Let's check how much it costs. Let's check that we can accommodate that. And how we do that, and let's check when we are going to monitor it. So it will be a corrective plan, it will be an implementation plan for the impact. So that's the due diligence part. And then, you know, monitor and measure.
It's impossible to talk about investment in general without talking about the government. You know, how do you handle regulatory uncertainties when it comes to investments? And I have to ask this specifically because the nature of impact investment comes, you know, interacts with a lot of sectors that, you know, overlap with regulations. So for example, there's no way you can touch energy without, you know, touching into regulation and the balance, you know, between the role of government and the role of, you know, private sector. But just to sort of narrow down the discussion, how do you overcome regulatory uncertainties, like, for example, changes in taxation policies, and how does it affect investors like Vital?
Yeah, as you say, it's always a challenge. I mean, you have to analyze and understand that as part of your risk analysis. And, you know, we work in emerging markets, we work in sub-Saharan Africa, and basically, you know, that's part of what you do. When you go into a business, you're trying to understand what's the risk coming from that side. And again, in different businesses, it affects differently. So I would say sometimes the more essential products, and if you're disconnected from any government, you work directly with the market, maybe less risky. And sometimes, like as you say, you know, in a power purchase agreement with the government, you're totally exposed to the government, right? I think it is a case-by-case thing, and it is exactly like currency, and, you know, how you deal with local currency, where your investors are, you know, are invested in foreign currencies, and us as Vital, we have to distribute in foreign currencies, like dollar, euros, but we invest in sometimes local currency businesses. So that's part of the, you know, where is this business? What, how is it related to the government? What's the risk from regulatory and market? I think it is a, it is much a case by case. I would say something interesting here that you know, you can easily analyze that in a well-developed market. I would say easily, but you can analyze the risks and understand where you are in developed market, you know, like Kenya, as you mentioned, and you can kind of get to a conclusion there and say, well, this is the risk, this is my mitigation measures, and decide if you're willing to go or not to go there. So you can work effectively here on a well-developed market. And you can sometimes work effectively in the very undeveloped market, you know, in the countries where you have the strongman president or the prime minister, and, you know, he wants to do something, and, you know, he will push it and make sure that that can happen. So that's another place that you can sometimes work effectively. So you can work effectively in the very well-developed market. And I'm talking about regulatory terms, right? Not in other operational terms. You can work effectively in a very well-developed market and in the places where it's very undeveloped and you have a strong man to actually, you know, make things happen by decisions or by quick decisions. And it's actually much harder to work in this middle spectrum where it's already bureaucratic, and but it's very hard to take decisions and things move slower. And you would look at the investment then, and I would say, for example, the regulatory would say, yeah, we just need to pass, you know, two or three laws and a few decrees, and, you know, it has to go to parliament. And then you say, okay, that's not for me. That will take that. I'll see that when, you know, that's not for this cycle. Let's see you in a few years, and let's stop.
You see, Nimrod, even in the allow me to call them intermediate markets, away from the fuel streams, there are still areas where, you know, businesses and government have common interests. Or in this case, for example, an investor, like both the government and the business, sort of have a keen focus in providing cleaner energy to the people, or enhancing last mile delivery. You know, in such cases specifically, how best can investors and companies work with governments to solve these issues?
It is a matter of, you know, of discussion and, first of all, having an access to all the information possible. So, for example, I think in power today, with all the Power Africa and all the evolution of the power purchase agreement and the power industry, I think you can understand and you can actually feel on a solid ground where you come and you're trying to invest. I think in other sectors, it still needs maybe an open discussion and maybe to work and build this specific definitions together, like, you know, water and other infrastructure. So I would say where the rules are set, just make sure that the information is available and it's fully transparent, and, you know, people know what's the rules from the beginning, so no one wastes time and resources on just getting to the place where you have the information. Where the rules are not yet set, it's either innovative or not yet very developed. It has to be an open discussion. I like the, you know, the blended finance approach. I think through blended finance, you actually go directly from the theoretical discussion to the practical discussion, because and then the interests are aligned. Everyone has skin in the game. Both the government, the investor, and the investee have skin in the game, and then the discussion is practical. So again, here, where it's already developed, just, you know, make sure the information is super clear and super transparent, and there's zero work to have it in front of you. And where it's not yet developed, I think having everyone working on the specific case with skin in the game. I like PPPs and I like blended finance approach, And I think that's a very good tool to focus everyone to, you know, how do we make this work? And if everyone, you know, the investee, the investor, and the authority have skin in the game there, they will all want to make sure that it works and not just to be, you know, gatekeepers or, you know, or only regulator. I'm the regulator and you guys, you know, struggle. I'm not helping. I'm just putting load on your venture. So I like these cooperative ventures.
So more of the best way to work out that model would be like having quote-unquote everyone's sort of financial interest in the pool.
For example, earlier PPP, everyone has financial interest in the pool. I think that's the quickest alignment that you can get. So I think sometimes, and it actually makes sense because where it is underdeveloped, PPPs with governments make sense. Where it is already very well developed, so sometimes you can let the market, you know, work for itself. So if it is an innovative idea or initiative or a not yet developed sectors, you can come, you can do PPP and then align everyone's interests. And if everyone has financial interest, people will be practical. You know what I'm saying?
Away from governments and regulation, let's talk about the vital impact relief facility. And I find this very interesting because, first of all, the facility launched smart in the middle of the pandemic, so April 2020. And from what I get from your website is some of the things that you were looking into is sort of provide a buffer for businesses to make it through the pandemic, specifically looking at how the pandemic was touching into other sources of investments like FDI, which will likely be for the interest of our listeners who might not have interacted with vital impact facility. What's the fund all about? What are some of the criteria for businesses looking to apply for the funding?
Sure. So as you said, it is a very specific initiative within Vital. So it's not the main core of what Vital does. And up to now, we talked really a lot about the equity investments and how we look at equity investments. And, you know, the equity stuff is usually big stuff. We try to make large scale impact and good financial returns. So that was the equity stuff. With the pandemic, we looked at what happens on the ground, and we actually saw the economic wave in sub-Saharan Africa arriving before the pandemic arrived. So you had COVID economical effects hitting Africa much, much earlier than the actual health crisis. And, you know, through our portfolio companies and our partnerships on the ground, we saw a peculiar new situation. We saw that SMEs that are great, that have, you know, good sound foundations and never needed the help from anyone might not survive. You know, lockdowns, supply chain disruptions, you know, a lot of uncertainties. So, and some of these guys, which were great SMEs, and when I'm saying great, they were good financially, okay? They were good businesses and they were creating great impact. That's at least what we want to look at. So we saw around us, around our portfolio companies, a few companies that were having trouble and actually got to a place where they might not, you know, pass to the other side, you know, weather the storm. And when these guys went, you know, as you mentioned, Ali, DFIs and all the, I would say, the global support mechanisms were all focused on something else now. And everyone made sure that domestically is safe. So a lot of capital that would usually come in a situation like that when it's regional now was deprived, and banks were not the solution because banks were treating their own clients, right? So you have what we've seen and what surprises is you have, again, a good business doing great, never needed any help, and now it might not survive. And when it goes to the bank says, oh, you know, I have so much, you know, who are you now? What do you want now? Let me save the guys that I'm already exposed. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And so that was one. And the second, it was, you know, lockdown. You cannot do large scale equity investment when you cannot be on the ground, okay? So we said, okay, we're going to have some time that we're not going to do, large scale equity investment is not possible. What are we trying to do? We're trying to do good financial returns and we're trying to do good impact. How can we do that now? And when I said before that we are trying to, bottom up. So that was the bottom up approach. What's happening on the ground? What's actually happening? That's one side. What are we trying to do? Impact investment. Let's find how we do it now during the pandemic. Let's not wait and talk about impact investment when, great SMEs are dying. You know what I'm saying? Let's put, the money where our mouth is. The reality on the ground is this. We can now do Zooms and we can do conventions and we can discuss on, many stuff. It will not help anyone. You know what I'm saying? We can sit confined in our house and discuss a lot of stuff in Zoom calls that will not help and that will not create impact and that will not be impact investing in this year. So, and that's where we launched the brief. We said, okay, let's look at these companies. Great, good companies, good foundations. We're not looking to, again, in the equity, we love turnarounds. We love special situations, okay? We can come and make a change. Here, no, we want someone which is great and, was doing great before. So let's look at these companies and let's see how we come in and we help them to go through the next stage and to weather this difficult situation and to continue creating the great impact and the great and the good financial returns that they were doing before. Let's look at it at SMEs. Let's look at it from that credit perspective and not equity perspective. And so it will be simple. So that's that. And we also looked at how we can accommodate that. We had a bit less of experience with that kind of operational investment. So we looked for, the best in the field, and we found Guido Boysen, and we called him to the flag, and he immediately loved the idea and took up the lead on that. So he joined Vital in order to do that. He has, There's no other guy that knows better than him how to invest in SMEs in Africa, from the credit perspective. And that's exactly what we needed on board. Guido worked in Brofin. He invested for more than 10 years. He led Brofin. He invested in many SMEs across the continent. And investing in SMEs, that's his craft. And, he knows everything that we would have needed to learn. So, that was a very, very good synergy and we're working great together. And so Peter is leading this facility. We identified the geographies, the sectors, we defined the criteria that we're looking for. Again, in order to look for these new missing middle, the good companies that are in trouble now. And we launched. So that was that.
Let me get this straight. So you guys launched a loan facility, if you'd rather, at a rather interesting time. Most lenders are trying to back off from lending. And if Kenya is anything to look at, banks were not as accommodating to lending to SMEs. And justifiably so, provisions rose throughout the roof and across the industry. Yeah. And just apart from the fact that, most businesses were, facing trouble. So, the chances of money coming back the way it's supposed to be would be slightly less than it would be in normal circumstances. You guys are also entering a new field. So you were flying blind into a new sector right in the middle of the pandemic. How was your experience? And essentially, how did COVID-19 affect some of the loans you gave out?
Yeah, so first of all, we start from the reality on the ground. So that was the need. It's not that COVID surprised us. COVID was what created the challenge and the opportunity. So that was a response to COVID. So everything that happened and is still happening, that's the target of this facility. So this facility is targeting exactly the rollout of the economical challenge.
Right.
about flying blind, I would say this. First of all, sectors, you know, markets and sectors are not new to us. So, you know, agro processing in East Africa is not a new market and not a new sector for us. We haven't lended to SMEs in this sector market. You know, we are well-versed in the sector and in the market. So we didn't go into something that we don't know. We went into markets that we're kind of familiar with and definitely to sectors that we're familiar with. You know, if you talk, you know, the latest, you know, energy and agro-processing are sectors that we are very familiar with, and some of our nicer and bigger equity investments are. About the credit operation, yeah, that was something that we needed to enhance the team with, and that's what we took Guido, which is, you know, the best navigator that you can take and the best pilot and navigator that you can think of when you want to, as you say, fly blind somewhere. So that was that. Now, how did the COVID affect? COVID affects, you know, disruption in supply chain, disruption in cash flow, the inability for these guys to take some credit, to go to the bank and take some, you know, normal credit that they would have been eligible to in normal days. That was the target of the fund. So that's why this facility is for. And the idea was, again, to be on the ground, not to have a concept and then go to the investors and fundraise and then, you know, and then come back to the market after so much time and the situation is changed. And the idea was, you know, we're on the ground, we see what's happening now, we took $10 million and, you know, we immediately, you know, opened the gates. So that was the idea. We saw and still see a lot of demand for this facility, and that definitely proves that the product was the right for the time. And we actually see how it helps and how it, you know, fulfills its primary mission. So I think that was a very, very interesting and good way to answer the local need and the dynamic environment that pulled up around the COVID.
Earlier you shed light into the fact that you guys invest in both local currency and foreign currency, and, you know, currency fluctuations are not new to Africa. You know, we've seen crazy cases in both in markets like Kenya and Nigeria. And, you know, smack in the middle of COVID-19, for example, the Kenyan shilling was not doing well against the dollar. Of course, during COVID and beyond COVID, what are some of the rough measures that Vital has just to mitigate, you know, such risks, and how does it affect, say, you know, some of your tools like the VIF?
Yeah, so you're right. It is a challenge. It is a big challenge. I think, again, we don't have any secret sauce. I think companies that have ingredients of export, you know, is a natural and good hedge. You know, if you have an export component and you get hot foreign currency for what you sell, then you're much less exposed to local currency. So we will, of course, we're very happy to look at the companies like that, and then a lot of the risk currencies is actually mitigated. And some of the companies that we invested in are doing exactly that. I would also say that it's short enough and long enough to be able to sustain momentarily fluctuation. So it's not, you know, it's not a 10 years or 8 years investment that you say, okay, let me try to guess what will happen or to estimate what will happen. And it's not, you know, 1 year that, you know, if something happened, then you're totally exposed. So I think to, you know, up to, you know, 48 months with a grace period that gives you a small buffer to accommodate fluctuations. But is it a risk? Yes, it is a risk. So local currency is a risk. You can mitigate it in some ways. You can be fully covered if you're working with companies that do exports, like, you know, Brazil nuts. But it's not that we have a full-on, foolproof solution for that. That's a risk.
Maybe just looking at some of the of course, the most recent facilities and the most recent loans that have. What are some of the things that we look forward to, you know, from the loan to so that they can pay that?
So, you know, first of all, there, you know, if we talked about who's eligible and what we were looking for with this facility, so these are great two examples, you know, great companies doing well, both financially and a lot of impact, you know, Privumnats working with thousands of smallholder farmers, you know, actually giving smallholder farmers the economy and the livelihood that these guys depend on. So that's an amazing impact. It's agro-processing, you know, it's within the country. It's not, you know, sending somewhere and someone else, you know, it's not sending raw materials. It's actually agro-processing within the country, working with smallholder farmers and doing well financially. What more can you ask? You know what I'm saying? That's exactly where we want to be. So it's a good market. It's an agro-processing sector. It's food agro-processing sector. It's doing great impact. It's working with high standards of ESG. It's export, so there's no local currency, almost no local currency. So currency exposure. So, and they needed our help. So that's a great company. I think what can we expect? I think we can expect more and more. You know, we can expect we would actually look at these places and say, you know, maybe these places are places that we can be even more involved. Now we have, you know, a hands-on initial introduction to this specific company and to this specific market, and maybe we can be more involved there. Again, as I said before, being practical and working where everyone has skin in the game, that's where you learn the fastest and that's where you understand the realities on the ground. Now, coming through that, understanding the realities on the ground, maybe we can enhance the collaboration. Maybe in the future we can come as equity investors. You know, so I think it works as a win-win to everyone. So I think, again, it's an essential thing, an essential need, both on the utilities and on the solar, you know, renewable energy projects. So again, a good company, great local management entrepreneurs, you know, grew up, came to maturity and to great both financial results and impact locally. And now COVID came and you can come and be involved. So the interesting thing is that I think that without COVID and without this, we would have never met these guys. You know, we would have never come across because they would not look for someone like us and we would not have looked for someone like them. So, you know, talking on making crisis into opportunity, that's a great example for both sides, you know, for both sides. So I think, again, here, what can we expect? We can expect looking more and being more involved, you know. You know how collaboration and partnerships work. You can talk a lot, but before you started working on something, before you have a few fire tests and a few small situations and challenges, you don't get to know each other. You know, like marriage. Before you have the first few challenging situations, only then you really understand, you know, who you are with. Partnership is the same, where you face together challenges and you build trust and you see that, you know, we actually want to go the same direction, then you can enhance the collaboration. And I think, you know, this facility is a great opportunity to do that.
At marriage. Nimrod, as we close the interview, close out, earlier we talked about the fact that, you know, the VIF is not vital, is about, it's just a segment of what you do. Maybe could you talk about some of the some of your other offerings, of course, within the sectors that you worked in, and maybe for some of the SMEs that are listening to this podcast, how can someone apply for the VIF?
Yeah, so here again, we try to make it as simple as possible. But let me just say that, you know, through this experience and through learning that, we are actually considering scaling this up because the need is so big. And again, I think it is a win-win. So we're actually considering and we're looking at making it bigger so we can help and collaborate with more and more SMEs. So that's something that is on the table, and we're looking on how to do that. Again, we wanted to be quick. We wanted to start operating. We wanted to be able to assist where the need was. But I think this kind of collaboration investment is definitely relevant to post-COVID environment. And you know, working with successful SMEs and supporting them, you know, to do better financial results and to continue and maybe broaden the impact is something that we want to do. So if we'll find a way to make it a bigger operation, not only COVID related, you know, it's definitely relevant to post-COVID. How to apply? We try to make it as simple as possible. You go to, you know, Vital Capital site. And the first banner there, just not to make the first thing on the app, you'll see Vital Impact Relief Facility. You click, and then you have access to all the documents, how you should apply, all the criteria. Again, not to waste anyone's time, the criteria of who can apply and who cannot. And you just, you know, you just apply through there. And we promised, and we do look at things very fast. You know, the idea is to be on the spot because, again, it was built for a dynamic environment. So, you know, we'll get a very quick response on, yeah, you're eligible, you're not eligible. If you are, let's go for due diligence. You know, do this, please do this and that, send us this and that. You know, we, of course, want to meet. It's not a banking transaction. We want to meet the guys. We want to be on the ground. You know, we want to spend some time, even though it's lending, we want to spend time on the ground with the guys. And everywhere we invested in, we spend time on the ground. And if you guys spend time on the ground, and if all work goes well and works well, yeah, let's collaborate.
Got it. I think this is all I had for today. I really, really enjoyed this chat. And hey, whenever we can do this more, we should. To our listeners, what Nimrud said, if you're interested in the work, just go to vital-capital.com, and it's the work is right beside the portfolio on the top right. Nimrud, thank you so much for joining us in this discussion, and I look forward to having others.
Amir, thank you very much for inviting me. I really enjoyed the discussion as well, and hopefully we'll have more and more stories to talk about.